Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 2, Canto 3, The Glory and the Fall of Life. And we had just preached last week, we read about those nude God children running in their play fields, smiting the winds with splendor and with speed. And we reached 127. The last few lines, imperious in their radiance like the suns. This is the nude God children. They kindled heaven with the glory of their limbs, flung like a divine largesse to the world, a spell to force the heart to stark delight. They carried pride and mastery of their charm, as if life's banner on the roads of space. As one, they are carrying the barrier, the banner of a griefless life through the universe and spreading that joy. So we can read on from the top of page 127. Ideas were luminous comrades of the soul. This is still about those joyful God children running through the world. Will you start, Anna?
Ideas were luminous comrades of the soul. Mind played with speech, cast javelins of thought, but needed not these instruments toil to know. Knowledge was nature's pastime, like the rest, investitured with the fresh heart's bright ray, an early God instinct's child inheritors, tenants of the perpetuity of time, still thrilling with the first creation's bliss, they steeped existence in their youth of soul, an exquisite and vehement tyranny, the strong compulsion of their will to joy, poured smiling streams of happiness through the world.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about this passage? Investitude, yes. When you are given some high responsibility, you may be given a special uniform to wear with it, which is the sign of that role that you're called upon to play. So they are nude God children, but a sign of their role is this bright ray of the heart, the joyfulness of the heart. And we're told that they wear that because they, as the God children, they have inherited an instinct, a God instinct, which belongs to the very early ages of the manifestation of the creation. They are living in eternal time, perpetuity of time. A tenant is somebody who rents a building or a place or a piece of land, and it is possible, I think, to rent something in perpetuity, forever. So not that they are not the owners of time, but they are allowed to run away through time, and they are still thrilling with the bliss, with the delight of the first creation. They steeped existence in their youth of soul. This is a soul youthfulness, and to steep something means to soak it in something. If you're dyeing a piece of cloth, you will steep it in the dye liquid, until it becomes saturated with that color. Or if you've got some precious herb and you want to make a healing drink out of it, you will soak it, steep the leaves in some health-giving liquid. So they are steeping the whole universe in their youthful soul delight. That forces the world to bliss, an exquisite and vehement tyrannic rule. no? Which forces those under it to obey. But this is a tyrannical compulsion of their will to joy. What they are spreading is smiling streams of happiness they are pouring through the world. So that even in the first line, it says that ideas which are often abstract, we separate mind from heart. No? But here, ideas were luminous comrades of the soul, and the mind plays with the speech and casts javelins of thought. These are tools of mind, thought, but they don't need those, mind doesn't need those instruments, doesn't work in order to achieve knowledge. Their knowledge was nature's pastime, like the rest. It is all a kind of amusement and entertainment and delight. Jocelyn, would you?
Rain, bread, meal, content, the fortunate gaze of them, thank you, yet air, a flood of joy on me, a plenty of tireless sweetness lived, like a song of the leaves of time, a large, spontaneous, overtree to wind, a sunrun winging of the breeze of the soul.
Thank you. And because of those smiling streams of happiness that those God children are spreading through the world, in that whole realm there reigned a breath of high immune content, a calm happiness which can't be damaged or lessened or injured in any way. Immune to damage or interference, yes. And it says, a fortunate gate of days in tranquil air. Your gait is your way of walking, no? The way that you go. So days pass like that. Fortunate, blessed days in tranquil air. There's no disturbance. There's a flood of universal love and peace. This is the glory of life, the true home of life. And there's a wonderful atmosphere, a sovereignty of tireless sweetness. There's something in us which gets tired of sweetness and it wants to have some different flavor, some contrast, some change, no? But there, this is the ruling atmosphere, tireless sweetness. It's like a song of pleasure on the lips of time, as if all time is singing with delight. And all this is possible because a large, spontaneous order freed the will. There's no effort or striving. There's a spontaneous order which allows the will all find its right way freely. And there's the soul is just nearly winging its way to bliss, unfrank. The word frank actually has to do with freedom. No? If you are frank, you speak freely, you feel freely, you don't cover up or disguise your feelings or your words. There's a very beautiful flower. It looks something like a sun, the gerbera. Nowadays we get them in big varieties of beautiful colors. Mother calls it frankness. This openness, nothing hidden, radiating light. And because there's this freedom of the will, this under this large spontaneous order, there's also freedom to act. the breadth and greatness of the unfettered act. There doesn't have to be any restraint on action, because spontaneously the action is willed according to the truth. So there's a golden liberty of the swift fire heart, spontaneously responding with energy and dynamism. There was no falsehood of soul severance. All souls are united in the one. But in these lower worlds, we feel this separation as if we're bit into separate bits. But that is not there. There was no falsehood of soul severance. A natural, spontaneous oneness ruled everywhere. And there's no crookedness of thought or word interfering to rob creation of its native truth, of the truth that is natural to it, that is its born birthright. All was sincerity and natural force. There, freedom was sole rule and highest law. It's a very, very different state from the one we know in this world, where self-awareness and self-control seem to be very, very necessary things in order to keep harmony, to keep progress. There, in this paradise, the home, the true home of life, all is spontaneous, all are sincerity and natural force. And there's not just one world, there are many worlds. Bhuvana, would you read?
So now the sunlight means the flower.
No, I'm sorry. Just to give the meaning of the word frank, I mentioned this flower.
Frankness.
Yes.
Freedom. But yes. Sunlight is...
So, that flower, frankness, it looks like a sun. No? And the sun, a sun has no need to hide itself or control itself or apologize for itself. It just goes on radiating its light and heat and warmth. So in the same way, the soul is just spreading its rays. That's the sense of this compound that Sri Aurobindo has made. Frank like the sun, free and open like the sun. Yes?
This is something to do with the life divine, or that's the way it's far away from this one?
Yes. How is this related to the divine life? Yes, I think the divine life on earth, all this experience would have to become natural here in our material world. It would be part of the realization, the divine life. But Asvapati is seeing all this happening in the subtle worlds, in the high origin from which our life has evolved. And what we're going to read about next is how did that life come down into matter and get changed into the life that we know? How did that distortion come about? It will be very described in great detail in the next coming cantos.
Asvapati is experiencing this by intuition, or is meditating, or how is it going? Is there something about this?
In the course of his yoga, he's been granted the soul freedom to travel through all the planes of existence. At the beginning of this book too, he was shown the way that all the different planes of existence are arranged in hierarchical order. And of course, matter is somehow the base of this world stair, this ladder of worlds. And the next one is the realm of subtle matter, which is relatively easy for us human beings to contact. No? The important thing is that we are carrying all these worlds potentially within ourselves. And that is why it is possible for a sufficiently developed human consciousness to climb up the ladder and explore the different worlds. King Asvapati is looking for the universal principle and power that will be able to bring this divine life and divine mind and divine substance here on earth to change the unsatisfactory life, the unsatisfying life that we experience here now into something that would be truly an expression of our souls and the soul of everything, a divine life upon earth. Asvapati is representing the seeker, the one, the aspirant who wants to find a principle and bring it down to earth. And to help him in that, he's been granted this capacity to see all the ladder of subtle worlds and start to explore them. So after the kingdom of subtle matter, which he found beautiful, delightful, but very limiting, he has contacted the worlds of life. And at the beginning of the canto, we got a description of the subtle realm corresponding to our life, a very doubtful, dubious, troubled, bewildered, sad realm where life was obsessed only with variety, with vast variety of different kinds of stimuli and experience. But at the end of the first section, Shobindo told us, this is not what life is really. No? On page 118, just before the break, after describing how the life goddess appears in connection with our world, he says, line 86, yet pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. Her moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her native right, and endless bliss is her eternal home. That is why Shobindo, unlike some other spiritual teachers, doesn't advise us to turn away from life. He says we have to conquer life, transform life into what it really is supposed to be, even here on earth, not just by escaping off to some paradise. What we are reading about, it sounds really like paradise, no? Where freedom is sole rule and highest law. And Sunilda has created such beautiful music to evoke the atmosphere of those higher life worlds. Asvapati sees all that, but what he really wants to find out is how has that perfect life, how has it become this life here, and how can we get back again? That is the theme of this whole part of the poem. And it's only at the end of Canto 8 that he will discover the secret key of nature's change. And then he immediately, now it says that he sees all these glorious worlds, but he can't enter them. He's still in his human nature, like we are. So Shobindo gives us a glimpse and makes us see those wonderful worlds. But here we are. We are still here. How can we experience them? Well, maybe in dream and memory and vision, we may get glimpses of them. But that won't change our world much. It may change our individual view of the world. But how can the world itself be transformed? That is Sri Aurobindo's mission, that is Asvapati's mission, Savitri's mission.
Do you think that is intrinsic to the change? That this previous way, or that this description of this blissful, sun-frank expression of existence, is that essential to a transformation?
Well, I would say it's essential to an aspiration. It's not going to be transformed unless there's a will and an intention and also a tremendous effort. And to inspire us to make that effort, we are given these glimpses. No? That's what Sri Aurobindo says. He's written in one of his aphorisms, probably Tuan can say the exact words, no? That if men could only see the glories that are waiting for us in those tracts that our animal evolution has not yet conquered, they would leave everything until they have found it and grasped it. So Asvapati's had a glimpse like that. He's glimpsed that glory and he said, that glory must be our home. That must be natural here on earth. Just to glimpse it is not enough. It's a help, it's an inspiration, but we want to live it. No, it's life, we want to live it as it should really be lived here in the material world. Does that answer your question?
Well, what if you don't get that experience? Then you go with what, faith or imagination?
Yeah.
Or?
Somehow the seed of that experience is, I believe, planted in every human soul.
Mother also mentions a previous life. She has a memory of an earthly paradise.
Of an earthly paradise, yes. She said that's when mental beings first incarnated.
Before that.
Yes. And
so it was a reality, it seems, on the earth in a bygone age.
Maybe that's what's going to be described here, the descent of life. But Mother actually mentions it's embodied mental beings and how the whole of nature was in a harmony.
Yes.
And it's a memory of that which is contained in the Bible legend of the Garden of Eden and in other early memories that there has been a perfect state on earth. So why and how was that lost? The story says that, oh, there was a serpent, no, an evil spirit. But where did that evil spirit come from? No? So Mother, in her account, says that there's another interpretation, that serpent was not an evil spirit at all. It was the force of evolution driving the earth development forward. No? That we had to leave our paradise, otherwise nothing would have happened. Where were we? Yes.
I have a question about line 411.
Yes.
No falsehood of soul separates. The way Sri Aurobindo is looking at the soul, is the soul then also severe and false?
No, the word severance means separation, cutting. So actually, the true state of the soul is one of love and union with all other souls, no? But we experience our individual little souls cut off from the rest, no? And the most important thing for us is to reunite with that soul truth. That soul severance has been part of an intrinsic part of the involution process, the process by which the one has become the embodied many in the world, in the manifested world. So as part of that, this soul severance has come about, and with it has come about falsehood and fear and anxiety and all these things which which spoil our life experience and make us feel, oh, it's impossible to live truly, for my soul to live truly in this world as it is. Better I go and sit in a cave in the Himalayas and absorb good vibrations until I have to leave my body, and then I'll be in a better world. That's not what Sri Aurobindo advises us. He says the soul has chosen to embody here for a purpose. So yes, it has to become liberated, but that liberation of the soul is the first essential step towards the transformation of the whole world, the divine life on earth. Who was next to read? Yes, please, Bhuvana.
in a happy, serious time of when these words, in moments of curious beauty and self-pride, in fields of grandeur and of title, life played at ease with their immense desires. A thousand even she could do not pass. No bond was set to her greatness and her praise, and to her heavenly purity. Always with the pride and strength of numerous souls, arising from the breast of some deep infinite, smiling like a newborn child at love and hope, in her nature housing the immortal's power, in her bosom bearing the eternal love. No guide she needed but her luminous heart. No wall deviates the Godhead of her steps. No alien night had come to blind her eyes. There was no use for grudging ring or fence. Each act was a perfection and a joy. Abandoned to her rapid fancy's mood and the rich colored riot of her mind, initiate of divine and mighty dream, magician builder of unnumbered forms, exploring the measures of the rhythms of God. At will, she moved her user wonder than a Dionysian goddess of delight, passion of creative ecstasy.
This is the true nature of life. So there's still a hierarchy of worlds, no? But it's a happy series. You can go up, climb up, or you can plunge down. All of them are realms of beauty and surprise, grandeur, tight and power. In these worlds, life played at ease with her immense desires, all her wishes and whims and caprices. She could build 1,000 Edens, 1,000 paradises, 1,000,000 paradises. She could build without stopping, just going from one to the other. There's no boundary set to her greatness and her grace, her infinite possibility, and to her heavenly variety, all those many, many different moods of the infinite. She can express and experience and enjoy them all. She is awake with a cry and stir of numberless souls who are participating in all this. It says, this cry has arisen from the breast of some deep infinite which lies at the origin of life. And she, the goddess, is smiling like a newborn child at love and hope. People used to think that newborn babies don't smile, no? They have to cry. But actually in recent decades, maybe over the last 40 years, there have been gynecologists who have realized that this is not necessary for birth to be attended by a cry. And very, very recently, our friend Kirit Taka from Gujarat, he was in Australia for the birth of his grandson, and within just a couple of hours of the birth, he sent me a photograph of that child. What a beautiful smile. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And there are many such images. So it is up to us to create the conditions. That's what Paula is doing, where babies can be born with a smile. Smiling like a newborn child at love and hope. And Helmut and I, we saw a clip on the, I don't know how we came to see it, on the YouTube, of twins, newly born twins, no? And they were together in their cot, all wrapped up in lovely warm clothes, and they were smiling and laughing and babbling at each other. Unbelievable. so delighted, you know, to be out of that, that confining womb and able to see it face to face and communicate. Really very, very touching. So this is something that belongs to the not very distant future.
One awareness or insight that I've had in that regard in the last year probably has been to follow beauty.
Beauty is his footprint.
I'm sorry, what has been?
To follow beauty.
Beauty is his footprint showing us where he has passed. We can follow him. Beauty in the arrangement?
Everything. Beauty in the care, beauty in the environment, in the actual respectful, very physical process of birth, and of the care, and of all of it, to always be seeing what is the beautiful thing here. And because it leads, it's like, it's a refinement.
Yes.
Mother also said that sometimes we brought up two children, they smile for no reason. And Mother said that's a psychic expression.
Yes. So that's what the divine life will be when the soul, the individual soul, all the collective souls can express themselves freely without any of these obstacles in the substance, in the consciousness. That's what will be, that's what we're aiming at. That's the promise that has been made to us. And that's why we're here, that our souls have received that promise and said, yes, yes, I want to be part of that. Whatever the difficulties, whatever the challenges. So life in her nature is housing the power of the immortal. She's carrying in her bosom, in her heart, the eternal will. She doesn't need any guide, only her own luminous heart. This is life pure in her origin. So far there's been no fall. No fall has debased, brought down the Godhead of her steps. And no alien night had come to blind her eyes. So many life levels are just blind. There's a dark consciousness preventing them from seeing the truth. So because of that, there was no use, there was no need for any kind of limitation, no grudging ring and fence limiting things. Each act was a perfection and a joy. So she's allowed to indulge freely. She's abandoned to her rapid fancies, moods, and the rich colored riot of her mind. Whatever comes to her fancy, she can indulge in. And she's very powerful. She's an initiate. She carries a secret knowledge, an initiate of divine and mighty dreams. She's an enchantress, a magician builder of unnumbered forms. What she's doing with her power and her fancy is to explore the measures of the rhythms of God. Here, I think measures, it is music and rhythms, no? And the steps of the dance. At will, just as she feels like, she wove her wizard wonder dance. She's a Dionysian goddess of delight, a Bacchant of creative ecstasy. I've often explained these two words before. Anybody wants me to explain them again? Not necessary.
Grudging,
you know, if you're grudging, you don't want to give much. No, does he deserve it? Really? No. Don't. Just give him a little bit. Yes. Who is this deep infinite? This is the deep infinite of the origin, of the supreme origin of the trans. What? Yes, all our numberless souls have arisen from the heart of some deep infinite. We all have one origin. Each individual soul has arisen from that immeasurably deep, infinite possibility, potentiality. Is it okay? Yeah. Dionysium.
And so this was done in a very hidden places, as a matter of fact, in Pompeii, where I've been in guard for more than 35 years, which are excavations in Italy. They got buried in the ashes and palm stones by a tremendous eruption in 79 AD of a volcano, the only one on the top of your Mount Vesuvius. There is a particular villa, which is called the Mystery Villa, due to the mysterious paintings, which is an illusion, which is an indication of the Bacchus cults, the Dionysian things, where you can see all these ladies participating in that cult. But it is publicly painted in one of the main rooms of the villa, suburban villa, which is a mystery, because women could not have wine. So what I want to say, he still connects it to the original pure significance,
yes,
of the information that the male society comes up and forbids the women to have that, what you need, the vital to create something. If you don't have the vital force, you cannot realize.
Yes.
I don't know if it comes clear what I'm trying to make it clear.
So these two words, Dionysian and Bacchant, they're connected with the two different languages, with Greek and with Latin. So Dionysus was the god, and all the great things that are given to a civilization, they're given by a god or a goddess. So Dionysus, and there's a beautiful series of legends connected with him, how he brought the grapes from the east. My beloved teacher Amal Kiran connected Dionysus with Krishna, because there's this idea of the moonlit revels of the heart, no? But what Tuan has been telling you, it's about how these things got expressed in society. And the worshippers, the Greek female worshippers of Dionysus, the god of wine and of divine intoxication. Mother has called the grape Ananda, no? This is the significance. So, when we drink wine and we want to get out of our normal consciousness, actually what we're aiming for is Ananda. What we get here on earth when we just get drunk, it's not Ananda at all. But they had these, like many peoples around the world, they had these rituals of getting out of the normal consciousness by the use of grapes or other fermented substances of different kinds. No?
Yeah, the etymology of the word divine is also very nice. When you connect it to the original Latin, vino, divine, divine. So that's a good excuse for me to take every now and then a glass of wine.
So the female worshippers of Dionysus, they were called minads, and this Sri Aurobindo uses this word several times in the poem. Also these bacchantes, they are the equivalent in the Roman society. They are the worshippers of Bacchus, the god of wine. So there's many fantastic artworks showing this worship going on. It may perhaps in Pompeii have been done secretly in the villa, But in Renaissance, we get the procession going on in the open air. No, there's Bacchus in his chariot being drawn by leopards, and dancing around him are the worshippers. There are female worshippers, and there are male worshippers also, satyrs and fauns and people like that. And in the Greek time, we gather from the stories that they danced in a circle in front of the idol of the god. The idol of the god would be carried around, and the dancers, the female dancers, would get intoxicated dancing around and round in a circle. So there are many allusions to this in Savitri. And as Duan said, Shobindo always takes this, what is seen as a kind of orgiastic behavior, in its original sense, that you're carried away by the god.
You see, when you go on of Dionysus, which enters now my mind, he's the husband of, he marries Ariadne. She's the lady who gives Theseus, when he's locked up in the labyrinth, where the Minotaurus is, and he should kill it, because every year, every so much years, Athens has to offer seven boys and seven girls to the Minotaurus, which is a half bull, half to feed it, to have the bad vibes towards Athens. So at a certain point, Theseus is sent, and he says he has to kill this beast, Then Ariadne, the daughter of the king, who keeps the beast, she gives him the trick to get out of the labyrinth, the wire. You know, you roll on the wire, and then you find your way out. When then she escapes together with him, at a certain point she finds alone on the beach because Theseus abandoned her. And then Dionysus comes and they fall in love in marriage. So Dionysus is connected to that lead thread that leads you out of the labyrinth of life.
So yes, in all the legends of all the languages, it's very, very interesting to trace the psychological symbolism which underlies them. And Sri Aurobindo seems to say in his book, The Secret of the Veda, that these symbols, these psychological symbols, it seems to have been widespread, shared culture over the whole earth at an early stage of humanity. And that's why we find similar legends popping up in different parts of the world and in different cultures.
It's interesting that Christianity adopted wine as the blood of Christ.
Yes, way of making it again sacred, no? Yes. Yeah.
What is the word he's using? I don't get the word that Sri Aurobindo is using for females, Descartes.
Sorry?
You said that Sri Aurobindo is using this word?
Menad. M-A-E-N-A-D. Menad. This is the Greek name for the female worshippers of Dionysus. And the equivalent in Latin is this word that comes in the last line here, bacchant. That's the Roman Latin word for those same female worshippers of the god of wine, Bacchus.
It's as if these two references to Dionysus and Bacchus would be to entice a person to think beyond, think past, or think a more pure understanding of those words. Because to me, I read those and boom, right away, well, there's alcohol and sex.
Yes, right.
That's what those images are to a modern mind.
Yes, so Sri Aurobindo giving us a different view on all these things. No?
Yeah. Yeah.
He says, what's behind? And that's a very, very interesting thing to do with, for example, since we have our Russian friends here today, I always am astonished by the deep psychological symbolism that has been preserved in so-called fairy stories, fairy tales. I mean, to me, these very clearly come very clearly through Russian fairy tales, but other people have found them in other traditional European stories. So perhaps those storytellers who were going around from place to place in different parts of the country We can look at them as just entertainers, but maybe they were passing on a deep occult knowledge. And Sri Aurobindo says the Vedic hymns themselves were like that, but they had a double meaning. There was a surface meaning which was just for the ordinary people to help them, support them in their lives and in their development. And behind there was the meaning that the rishis knew, which is a much deeper psychological symbolism. And Savitri itself is one of these stories. It's one of these wonderful fairy tales that are remembered and celebrated. But what Sri Aurobindo has used it for is to bring out the deep psychological knowledge that lies in these symbols, to share all that wonderful knowledge with us, the knowledge of the rishis, his knowledge.
I think there's still very much a confusion in the modern mind between this ananda and this pleasure, because Narad told a story today in the Mantra Mandir work about this Indian coral tree. He said it produces in the morning, the birds come about 5 a.m. and they drink the nectar from this flower. And they get happy and rejoice. But a few hours later, it turns to alcohol. And they still come and drink it. And then they get
woozy.
So I thought it's a good lesson in nature of the silliness of man. Yeah. And this thing about the wine in the church to me is a definite deformation of this. Because Mother said the grape is the divine ananda.
Yes.
So as soon as it goes,
as it gets made into wine.
Because Shraddha told a story the other day from the Kano Upanishad, and it says, that Brahman, in other words, the divine, know it as that delight. That's the highest expression of Brahman. So people get it mixed up, you know?
Yeah,
and still
wine,
we have
The wine that is the ritual item in a Christian mass is due to the Last Supper when Jesus shares his wine and bread with his disciples during the Last Supper. And that is symbolized during the liturgical functioning in Mass. That has nothing to do with
wine. No, it's turned
wine.
To passion.
Wine was a common drink.
The,
it's like,
as soon as it turns to pleasure and passion.
But one can think of it as in another way, just like Sri Aurobindo is doing here. He says, yes, life is like this. But this is not the true origin. This is not the true significance of life. So don't just abstain from alcohol. Find out what is life really about. And its origin is divine. And it has to be made divine again. But there's been a whole purpose and meaning about this process of involution. And now we're on the evolutionary upward way, and we have to see things differently from the way they are on the lower levels. So, what time have we got now? So I'd like to look at the very next sentence, because this is something significant in this discussion. Ilso, would you read?
This world of bliss, he saw and felt its call, but found no way to enter into its joy. Across the conscious gulf, there was no bridge. The darker air encircled still his soul. Tied to an image of quiet life, in spite of burning and warming sense, to a sad hope by great experience formed, and vision dimmed by care and sorrow. All this seemed only a bright, desirable dream, conceived in a longing distance by the heart of one who walks in the shadow of first pain.
Thank you. Aswapati sees this world of bliss, which Sri Aurobindo has been so beautifully describing to us. And he feels its attraction, its call. but he finds no way to enter into its joy. He can see it from a distance, feel its attraction, but he can't enter there. Across the conscious gulf, there was no bridge. It's as if there's a huge, dark gap in consciousness between what he can see and what he can experience. Why is this so? This is because a darker air encircled still his soul. His soul is tied to an image of unquiet life, just like our souls. We can't enter into that paradisal state because here we are. This is what we know as life. No? This is what our soul identifies as life. In spite of yearning mind and longing sense, our very bodies yearn for bliss. No? He is tied to a sad thought by grey experience formed. We think, yes, yes, it all sounds very nice, but that's not what we experience. No? His soul is tied to a vision that is dim. It's made dim and shadowy by care, by anxiety and sorrow and sleep, unconsciousness. So all this beautiful world of life seemed only a bright, desirable dream that's been dreamed up, it's been conceived in a longing distance by the heart of one like Asvapati, like us, who walks in the shadow of earth pain. These are the conditions of earth.
It's the realization of the psychic being that is the bridge.
That would make the bridge, yes. Would you read currently?
Although he once had felt the eternal's clasp, too near to suffering worlds, his nature lived, and where he stood were entrances of night. Hardly too close beset by the world's care, can the dense mold in which we have been made return sheer joy, through light to light. For its tormented will to think and live, first to a mingled pain and pleasure woke, and still it keeps the habit of its birth. A dire duality is our way to be.
Thank you. Asvapati has had amazing spiritual experiences on higher levels of existence, great illuminations. And he has felt the clasp, the embrace of the eternal. But his nature, his human nature, still lives too near to suffering worlds, our suffering worlds. And where he stood, there are entrances of night, ways down into the darker worlds of unconsciousness and falsehood. And Sri Aurobindo explains that it's very difficult for the dense mold in which we have been made, that means the substance of our bodies. This is too dense, it's too heavy, it's simply not able to return sheer joy to joy. Divine delight may touch us, but our substance can't respond. It can't return pure light to light. Sri Aurobindo allows us to bathe in this wonderful truth light, but our souls may respond, but our substance finds it very difficult to respond. Because our physical being is driven by a will to think and live, which is tormented, which is suffering. And why is it suffering? It's because in the process of evolution, matter woke up to a mixture of pain and pleasure. In fact, that has been the whole spur for human, for all development, all evolutionary development, reward and punishment. A little bit of pleasure, and then if you do the wrong thing, the punishment comes. No? And still, our substance keeps the habit of this birth, of this mingled pain and pleasure syndrome. A dire duality, a terrible set of oppositions characterizes our way of existence. And he's going to explain to us how this has come about, the time. We can read further. Norman.
In the crude beginnings of this mortal world, life was not, nor mind's play, nor heart's desire. When earth was built in the unconscious void, and nothing was save a material sea, identified with sea and sky, and so the young gods yearned for the release of souls, asleep in object vain, in animal. In that desolate grandeur, in that beauty bare, in the deaf stillness, mid the unheeded silence, heavy was the uncommunicated look of Godhead in a world that had had no means. For none was there to feel or to receive this solid mass which brooked no throbs, could not contain their vast creative birth, immersed no more in matter's harmony. The spirit lost its statuesque repose in the uncaring trance it groped for sight. Passion for the moons of a conscious heart, famishing for speech and thought and joy and love in the dumb, insensitive weaving, day and night. Hungered for the beat of yearning and response.
Thank you. So in the very beginnings of this physical world, when there was no life and no mind, no yearning heart, when Earth, this planet Earth, was built in the unconscious void of space, there was nothing except a material scene. There was only matter. The divine souls that were inhabiting this Earth were identified with material things, with sea and sky and stone. There wasn't anything else. Perhaps last week I mentioned Uddha's experience, that he once, Uddha, disciple of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, he once told the mother that he'd had an experience in which he was a pebble on a beach, and he was, as a pebble on a beach, he was aware that Mother and Sri Aurobindo were close to him, also as pebbles on the beach. And Mother said, yes, it's true. But there was an aspiration. Those young gods, those young godheads, yearned for the release of these souls that are asleep in the pebbles, in the objects, vague, inanimate. So there's a movement of aspiration in that desolate grandeur, in that bare beauty of the purely physical world, in the deaf stillness and the unheeded sounds. There must have been lots of sounds, actually. The sea roaring and the volcanoes exploding and vast winds, but there was nobody to hear. Nothing to hear those sounds. But what they felt was this uncommunicated load, this load of Godhead, of divinity. How can that be expressed in a world that has no needs? There's no conscious being there to feel or to receive all the new possibilities. All this matter, this solid mass, which doesn't allow any senses, any sense impressions, couldn't contain that vast creative urge that was in all those souls. So that changed something. This is a very important moment in evolution, this moment of aspiration, because somehow that total unconsciousness of matter gets shaken, immersed no more in that perfect harmony of matter. The spirit within, lost its statuesque repose. There it had been, stone and sea and sky, like a statue. But this is this uncaring trance of matter. But some consciousness wakes up. Sri Aurobindo describes this in several places in the poem. But this is a very remarkable one. No? This groping for sight. We don't even know what light is, but something in us is feeling out for it, passionately, passioned for the movements of a conscious heart, famishing. Famishing is when you're starving to death, when you have to eat. Famishing for speech and thought and joy and love. All that aspiration became so intense, in that dumb, insensitive, wheeling day and night where nothing changes. There's a hunger for the beat of yearning and response, communication. So that in conscience, that perfect harmony of matter, the poised in conscience is shaken with a touch. And the intuitive silence trembles with a name. Those souls cried out to life, to the life principle, to invade the senseless mold of matter, and to awaken the possibility of divine consciousness in all these forms, these objects. And life heard the call, and she descended. We'll read it next time. She poured out all her gifts on this material world. But while the magic gift was on its way, a dark, ambiguous presence questioned all. And we'll have to understand about the mystery of that dark presence. That's what Aswapati is going to explore through the next six cantos. How come that divine goddess here in the grip of matter has become the life that we know, and how can it change? You can ask a question.
I can also wait until next week.
You can ask now, and then we can listen to Mother reading
the
last passages. He says, actually, here at the beginning, in the crude beginnings of this mortal world. So mortal, this suggests, it's all in the grip of death. And in the purely physical form, death takes the form of entropy.
Yes. Entropy.
That's what the physicists say, that everything in this universe is disintegrating. There's a certain truth in it. Not the whole truth.
Are these young gods?
Yes, these gods are just emerging, no? They haven't been embodied yet properly. They're just beginning to be separated from the One. And actually that's a very joyful state. But they're so confined in the grip of matter. They're identified with sea and sky and stone. It's a mystery. That's his vastness. And the god of sky, that's also another vastness. But the stone, matter, which is the characteristic principle of this universe we live in, thanks to Sri Aurobindo.